Hello and welcome to the GMBN podcast. This week is something really special, especially for us bike nerds, as I sat down with Jordi Cortez. Now, for those of you that don't know, Jordi heads up Fox Factory Suspension at World Cups, giving technical support to the fastest riders in the world as they hunt down precious seconds. You might have seen Jordi on Fox's YouTube series called Dialed, where his no BS, straight talking and dry wit have made him a real fan favourite. Now, I've got to hold my hands up in error this week as I made a slight technical mistake whilst recording the podcast. What it essentially means is that occasionally, and only occasionally, you're going to hear my audio come through Jordi's channel. I hope it's not too distracting and I thank you for your patience. Hope it's not too distracting. There's so much great information from Jordi. Today, we talk recent product launches, athletes, and when, if ever, we will reach the limit of single crown fork design. Thank you very much, and I really hope you enjoy it. So we're sitting down today with Jordi Cortez of Fox. Now, Fox have got this really, really cool internet series called Dialed, which I strongly recommend checking out. Jordi, welcome to the GMBN podcast.
Thanks, Henry. It's good to be here.
So Fox have kind of had a really big and very important, I feel, launch recently with the Fox 38. Do you feel it's kind of, it is a big moment for you guys? I mean, it must have been years in the works.
Oh, it's huge for many reasons. One is that it's a lot of product. It's two forks and a shock. Well, two shocks if you count coil and air, plus updates to other product. Oh, sorry, it's three forks. It's the 40, the 38, the 36, the DHX2, the FloatX2, and then some updates to other products. So it's a massive launch for us. And it's kind of the first big launch since we've merged with Raceface and internal structures have changed a little bit. So yeah, it's been a big deal, not to mention that the whole coronavirus thing took off right at the pinnacle of doing all the work for the launch. So some people had a real rough time sorting everything out.
I bet. Because how long was the... I mean, the 38 has been something of a strange phenomenon because it's been sort of in everyone's faces almost, but it's also quite hard to spot. I think it was only when the separate arch, well, the different style arch was really visible, that people really started to cotton on that a new fork was coming.
Yeah, I was surprised that it didn't pop out sooner. I mean, there were a few little spy shots here and there, but really nobody picked it up. I don't know if people just didn't care or if it was just, you know, one more thing out there or if it didn't look different enough. It's funny now that it's launched, everybody's making comments about how ugly it is and how the arch is hideous and... But back when we were riding it for 8 months before it was launched.
Do you think, when it, I think it was in Zermatt, and that's when the kind of momentum started building. And the thing everyone said straight away was, oh, e-bikes. And, was that the kind of, do you think it would have happened without e-bikes?
Oh, for sure. This project has nothing to do with e-bikes. I mean, a stiffer fork helps because it's a big, heavy bike, but... The people that are riding e-bikes aren't pushing these technological innovations in suspension yet. Maybe that's going to change, but right now we're a race company and we've always been a race company. And that's what drives our product.
Because you have a really unique position, I think probably, there aren't many people in the world actually. I mean, you get top mechanics work with top racers, but you seem to service so many of the world's best riders. How does that responsibility kind of sit with you?
It's made me gray, that's for sure. It's tricky. I mean, a lot of these guys are good friends as well. And I struggle with, not necessarily with providing them all what they want, which is not that hard, you know. It takes a bit of time, but they all get equal treatment for the most part. But I want them all to win. Even guys that aren't on our forks, like some of those guys are good friends, and it sucks when somebody has to lose.
But is it a case of, like a parent loves all their children equally, but they still love some children more than others? You know what I mean?
For sure. Yeah, I mean, that's the case. If you met 10 people, they wouldn't all be your best friend.
Now, I'm not going to ask you who the hardest person to work with, but who's some of the easiest people that just, you know, just get it completely and utterly?
I mean, there's easy in that they don't take up any of your time.
But I suppose return on investment, that might not be.
Right. So, and then there's easy in that you put some time in and you get results. So, like, Eddie Masters gets results.
Yeah.
I don't think he's ever come into the tent for a suspension setup.
If you ask Eddie anything, all he says is, okay, a day, that's all you've got to do. I'm like, Eddie, I think there's a bit more to winning an EWS than climbing 1,000 meters a day. No, just okay a day, mate. Oh, for God's sake.
Says something about his level of ability.
Do you think that sometimes for riders, you know, from my experience when I was working as a mechanic, there were some riders where actually there wasn't as much technical information in terms of, sorry, their technical understanding sometimes wasn't as high as, it wasn't like Formula One drivers saying, oh, we need a bit more wing or something like that. It was actually, do you feel that sometimes you're having to really interpret what these riders are saying? Or?
Oh, yeah, you always have to interpret it. I'm just thinking of relevance between, we go back and forth on this a lot, and being a driver in a car and being 1/16th of the weight of the vehicle, it's very different picking out what the car is doing.
Yeah.
I'm not going to say easier, but it's far less dynamic. It's a lot easier to say, hey, this corner's doing this, this corner's doing this. I need downforce here. A rider on a bike that's 5 times the weight of the bike, you make the smallest change, like you have a big breakfast or you wear a different kit.
Don't have a big poop.
Yeah, exactly. It changes everything.
That's how to get your sag levels just right, kids.
Yeah, you got to track all that stuff.
But, you know, with a Formula One driver or, you know, a lot of kind of top athletes, they'll come back after maybe not nailing it in qualifying or not getting it done in the race, and they'll say, the car just wasn't there today. But in mountain biking, we tend to, the level and responsibility tends to come on the rider first. Oh, I know, I just wasn't feeling good on the bike today. And then often the bike second. Do you feel as the sport is getting ever more professional, that will change in years to come and people will say, I just couldn't find the setup?
Not in the foreseeable future, no. Again, it's just there's too much rider input to make it that finicky. Obviously, as everything progresses, bikes get better, suspension gets better, it's going to move closer to that. You won't be able to ride a bike and win a World Cup. But right now, I mean, bikes are the only thing in the world that suspension's all over the place. Nobody's sat down and said, hey, this is the way you build a bike and this is the kinematic and this is what you need. Whereas motos and cars are very close. Bikes are like, people are still designing suspension linkages. You know, they wake up in the morning and go, oh, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to put a link here and a link here, and then I'm going to have it rotate here. That just doesn't happen.
Yeah, it's funny. Hey, you know, in mountain biking, I feel that, as you know, whenever I do these podcasts, I always end up talking about it, but predominantly I'm a fan of the sport first, and I kind of work in the sports secondary. And I feel that the conversations around mountain biking have changed so much since kind of when 29-inch wheels came around. That's all people spoke about. But now people's understanding is better. And so we talk about more, you know, more nuanced point. I was doing this, I was putting together geometry of trail and enduro bikes for the last 10 years. And when they released a bike like 8 years ago, half the time, some companies didn't even put out a geometry chart, you know. It was just, there we go. And it's just so interesting how much more refined and educated the consumer base is coming. And I wonder, you know, we get often asked a lot about what is this fork? And I think you guys say it best when it's just like, go and experiment and find out, because there's one thing about having a conceptual understanding, it's another thing knowing what it feels like on your bike. But as the consumer base gets educated more, it'll be really interesting to see what else we pick up on and whether actually people stop saying, oh, I like that bike because I know, for instance, it's good on maintenance, you know, whether that argument will kind of fade away.
Which still has some validity.
It does have some validity. I said it, and I realized how completely unfair that was.
But yeah, no, I totally get what you mean. I mean, we still get, you'll sort through online comments, and even with the new fork launch, like, it's a good fork. There's a lot of good forks out there. I'm not saying we're the best. Mm-hmm. But somebody else, just for no apparent reason, will be like, oh, Fox, I only ride this. And it's a company that you know is just absolute garbage, and nobody's been able to make stuff work. There's so much emotional involvement with some of this stuff that it kind of throws logic out of the window a lot of times.
I once got told that, you know, like, fine art is a really interesting thing because often value is it's a denotation of quality.
Yeah.
And that's largely what people go off. And it's funny how there are some companies, and this is mountain biking as a general, which for whatever reason got their pricing just right, where they weren't taking the piss, but they were justifying a boutiqueness. And it's really interesting because once people get that, it takes a huge amount of for them to snap out of it and realize that maybe it wasn't as good as they thought it was.
Oh yeah, there's definitely brands that are still riding that one.
And I'm sure I'm like it too. Like, I'm not, you know, I'm a human. I'm going to be just as susceptible to those problems. But some of my loyalties and things, biking or not, that I've probably fallen into, I should probably actually question them more because, you know, marketing and things like that really do play their part. And, you know, we're all under the influence.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've had two friends come back to cycling after, you know, maybe 5 years. And even 5 years ago, people were just starting to talk about reach and chainstay versus, you know, front center versus rear center and head angles. You didn't really look at those things much when you bought a trail bike or an enduro bike. You just kind of picked a bike that looked good and had the right travel. Yeah. And I'm telling them, well, the chainstay on this thing's really short. The reach on this one's short. Head angle doesn't match the geo. And they're like, oh man, I never even thought to look at that stuff.
Yeah.
But now you can find it everywhere, and it's cool. It's not hard. It's really like three or four numbers.
Do you think that, you know, if you go back, I think just before reach really started gaining momentum as such a vital figure, it was literally, they'd just say the head angle and they'd be like, oh, that's a good bike. That's a bad bike. Oh, that's a good bike.
Makes no sense at all. Like, I don't know what top tube number means anymore.
Yeah, it's funny. Because I still don't know how I feel, because I think I try not to be too entrenched in my views. I mean, I do like playing devil's advocate. I do like winding people up. So sometimes I will play the caricature of myself. But, you know, it wasn't so long ago, like, you know, a couple of years ago, where it was, oh, you know, short rear ends. And now I'm thinking actually I want quite a long rear end, and, you know, and loads of stuff like that. And so I think, coming back to what we were saying earlier on, the best thing you can probably acknowledge is that you don't know everything.
Absolutely.
While striking the balance between, it's hard, eh?
There's a few people out there that are telling you how it is. That if you're not doing this, you've done it wrong. And I've been doing this for so long that I know exactly how it should be. You're done. Like, you're already wrong. As soon as you've made an absolute, you might as well just quit. You might have some good ideas, but it's not going to fit everybody, and it's not going to be what everyone wants. And it might not be the right thing when other innovations are made and everything changes again.
Yeah, it's funny. I thought somebody I've always thought was just like, had such a good attitude was actually Mick Hanna, because I think he's been around the block now to know what's really, you know, what's just, you know, dust in the wind. Oh, he was great. He would just cut the crap big time. He's such a good guy for that. Now, speaking of all these pro racers, and, you know, obviously you're there at races to help them gain speed. When I go riding, I'm there to drag brakes and case jumps. Those are my primary objectives. If, you know, I rocked up to Fox and said, make me faster, how much do you think you could do with somebody that has a kind of ballpark good setup and an afternoon?
I mean, that's tricky to answer what a ballpark setup is. I would say for the majority of people that come and ask that question, we could do quite a bit. But you could do quite a bit as well.
Yes.
Very few people put in the time to go set up their suspension. Very few people even set up sag, which is the first
crazy
thing. Yeah. You just spent, I don't know, 5,000 pounds on a bike, and half of that is suspension.
But do you think that that would help? Because this is what I've wondered. If you gave geometry, if manufacturers specified the geometry at sag and then said, you need this sag to get your magical head angle number and to get your magical seat tube number, you've got to get the sag right. And maybe that would start a conversation, because there are so many bikes that I just think it, a static two-dimensional geometry chart just doesn't do things justice. And there's got to be some way where we've got to get kind of bums on seats, if you'll excuse the pun, of the idea of, you know, doing stuff differently to kind of to get people just to set up the fundamentals. Your bike, when compressed, should be in this range for the bike to work properly. It doesn't seem so crazy.
It's not crazy. And I don't know why the bike industry is so hesitant. I guess it's just, it's really an entry-level thing. Anybody can go buy a bike. Not everybody goes and buys a moto, right? There's a little bit of trepidation there in buying a big enduro bike or something. But pretty much anybody that buys a motorcycle goes and checks sag. Like, yeah. It's in the manual. It usually says it on the side of the motos. It's like, you do this, it comes with a spanner. Everybody does it. I mean, bikes, even good riders don't check sag. They take stuff out of the box and just put it on the bike.
Do you think, though, that in terms of sag, do you think you can have a fast setup that isn't whittling your hands down to hoops? Because when we were doing telemetry testing with Tracy, we got her set up a lot faster, but it was far less comfortable. Do you think that a fast setup is inherently uncomfortable?
I mean, yes, but not. And it's, again, you're kind of drawing tricky comparisons. Like, it's always going to be less comfortable than a soft, slow setup.
Right? Yeah.
You're hitting things faster. So, and the frequency of the bumps doesn't change. You're just hitting them harder. So the little ones that are really contributing to that hand fatigue are going to be worse. As suspension and geometry gets better and better, it's going to get also better and better. Things will be easier to ride. A lot of times now, and always in the past, we've been making up for kinematic flaws in bikes with suspension. And that's really hard to do. You need both things working equally to be able to have a perfect setup. You can't take a bike with no progression and just add a bunch of damping and hope it's going to work, because there's always a balance, yeah?
Yeah.
There's a balance between spring and damping. And if you have to add way more of one or the other, then something's not going to feel right. So as those things start to get more in line and geometry gets better and better and suspension gets better and better, the setups will feel far better. And I think this year is going to be a big step up, at least for us, as far as tunability. And the first few guys on the Enduro Fork on the 38 and the Shock, we were testing on a kind of a downhill track, short, 2 minutes. And that usually doesn't work for Enduro guys, because they set it up to do these two-minute runs and very specific for those conditions, and then you go ride it somewhere else and it feels horrid. And this is the first season where we've done that, and then we've said, okay, go do a pedal and go ride some other trails, and they've come back and said, holy like, this is still absolutely fine. It feels soft and supple, but I can push hard. So that's big for us.
Do you think that, and without trying to, I don't want to get too bogged down in the tech, but just from my own interest and perspective, do you think that is, and on the, is it, I don't know if it's just the 38, but the different leg lengths to maximize the negative air chamber? Do you think it helps the negative air? You know, you can kind of get that spring rate just where you want it. And
yeah, it's a huge part of everything, is balancing negatives and positives, and not just the volumes of the tube, but the surface area of the air piston, the size of the air chamber. Like, air springs are crazy. There's so much going on there. And they're only getting better and better.
I've kind of got an idea in my head as a good way to explain them about, like, you know, like a playground seesaw? Something about that, like preloading one end and being like, in terms of breakaway forces, and then like keep adding bags of sugar and try and like But so as soon as quarantine's over, I'm going to try and not look suspicious at a playground with like 400 bags of flour.
Good luck with that.
Yeah. So because there are so many different brands, and I think it's fair to say there are kind of two brands that are really leading the charge in terms of, you know, the amount of bikes that are equipped with their suspension, you know. But there are so many brands doing really, really cool stuff. You know, I think you've got people that are just, you know, like, I just think of some of the Italian brands like EXT and Formula, and then, you know, like Fast Suspension. I mean, everywhere, absolutely everywhere. Do you think it's talking about, you know, geometry and kinematics, you know, the way a fork works dynamically can vary so much. Do you think that, you know, an axle to crown height varies so much? Do you think that sometimes we kind of blow over the lines in terms of, you know, it's 160mm fork, but actually that can be, you know, the way the sag works and the way that where the ride height is, it can be very different. Do you think that going between brands is sometimes kind of glossed over when actually it is, can be a really big difference?
Definitely. All those things matter. And that those are some of the numbers that are just starting to come into play now of keeping axle to crown heights the same. I mean, very few riders, if you ask them, would know what relationship from bar to bottom bracket is.
Yeah.
And that's almost everything. Like, if your hands aren't in the same place each time, how are you going to know? And if you're saying, oh, I have three stem spacers, that doesn't tell me anything. If you go build a new bike and you put three stem spacers on, it's going to be different than your old bike.
Well, you're the perfect person to speak to then. What is the measurements when you're going between your bike that you think are important? I've got my own one and it's stupid, but to the top of the grip from the floor, I like to be about 108 centimeters. But that doesn't take into account bottom bracket height.
Which is fine, right? It's something.
What do you recommend?
I still think, obviously, from center, from BB to your grip is incredibly important.
Yeah.
So however you're going to get there with stem length, bar roll, whatever, all those things come into play, and people are constantly rolling bars back and forth or changing this or that, or even bar width is going to change that number.
Mm-hmm.
So from BB to top of handlebar, and from the reach number as well from a vertical line out to the bar.
Yeah.
You just need to know where those contact points are at all times. And seat plays a part also, because you're usually kind of locating the middle of your body with the seat. You always want to find it.
Yeah.
You don't necessarily sit on it, but it's always there. And if you take it off, even if you're not using your seat, you took it off, you wouldn't be able to ride your bike very well. It's so disconcerting.
Yeah.
And when these guys are looking at millimeters of difference, and you move the seat a little bit and you go to put your leg there to push something and the seat's not exactly where you thought it was, there's always that split second of that little panic where, oh, where is it? And then you find it.
It's funny because Chris Porter said the exact same thing about relation, contact points and their relation to one another. It's almost, maybe it's time that I started listening to people that I ask a question, they tell me an answer, and I should probably actually adopt my own methods. But who knows?
But it's also a very hard number to find on your own, right?
Yeah, true.
It's, you'd need a couple people and a level and a plumb bob, and we've had some pretty interesting measuring sessions at the truck trying to level everything, and then somebody's holding this level and this plumb. And
it makes me laugh, though, because the biggest, I feel like, with a lot of going between a lot of 650 and 29, one of the biggest and most disconcerting thing for me is sometimes, you know, like you said, it can, oh, but it's got the same amount of spaces, but there's can literally be 30 or 40 mil difference in bar height.
Oh, yeah, completely.
And like, that's why the 29er feels like quite hard in turns and stuff like that. And so that's my only reasoning was when I started going between different wheel size bikes a lot, and I was like, something's got to be done because this is absolutely horrific.
At least, I mean, it's something. You got to start somewhere.
Yeah, totally. Now, going back with your time at Fox, could you briefly describe where the RAD program came from and what it means to Fox?
That started with my boss in the very early days, Mark Fitzsimmons. He's the guy that hired me, my ex-boss. He's now decided to ditch this and go do other things that were less stressful. It's always meant a lot to Fox. Again, like, we were founded on racing, and until recently, we've really not had a marketing department. Our marketing was the race department and winning races. So we've definitely taken some flack for that as being a company that values all-out performance in a race situation rather than building things that are super easy for anybody to hop on and set up, but maybe when you really start pushing them, don't work that well. So obviously now we're trying to encompass everything and make them comfortable and fast, which has been hard, but I think this year we finally got it. But the RAD program has always let us kind of push those boundaries and do things that maybe won't make it into production, but are sure going to give us some good information about what works and what doesn't as far as racing goes.
Well, there was one thing that you prototyped many years ago that I thought was absolutely fascinating, and I just wanted to use this opportunity. I think it was probably Mont Saint-Anne, 2010 or 11, Geatherton on some inverted forks.
The upside-down fork, yeah.
Would you? What? Because some people really feel passionately about inverted forks.
Yeah, go buy one. Have at it.
What did you find? Because obviously there was enough interest there to go to the bother of making this thing. Was it just stiffness just never there?
The stiffness has never been there. There's other things as well. Adjustability is a bit tricky. Getting them anywhere close to the weight of a normal fork. I mean, people have tried and tried and tried, and it just never works. Bikes are so different. They're so much lighter. That extra pound and a half of weight, 2 pounds, 3 pounds in some cases, and they're still not stiff. I mean, there's still a couple forks out there, huh? But DVO was kind of the last big company to push an upside-down fork.
Yeah.
And you couldn't keep the front wheel pointed in a straight line ever. And it was quite heavy. It's a cool thing to do as a marketing exercise, but it's going to cost you some money and nobody's going to be able to ride it.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's something that must be so frustrating because I feel that, you know, there are some people, well, in every section of society that are disproportionately loud for how many people they actually represent. You know what I mean? Like, oh, we need an inverted. And then you try and give it to them, and it turns out it was only two people. And it's like, oh.
And I guess the big thing, I mean, from what I remember, motos kind of went to inverted forks because of axle overhang, right? With 11 and a half, 12 inches of travel, you needed this lower that was so far below the axle that it was dragging in the dirt and causing clearance issues, and bikes don't have that issue. We're running 8 inches of travel for the most part. So we don't need that overhang. So there's really no point in driving that upside down fork. It never really works. Maybe there's going to be some wonder material and we'll make an inverted fork. But again, the question is why? We're not having stiffness issues. We're not having weight issues. There's some people say that the inverted forks tend to lubricate bushings better because they're flipped upside down and the oil sits on the slider and stanchion better, but we don't have that problem.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I mean, it seems like fixing a problem that doesn't necessarily exist.
Exactly.
But I feel like it's that whole, finding a mouse in your KFC. It's one of those urban myths that it happened to somebody's brother's friend. And it's the same way that everyone says, and they've got a set of inverted forks and they say they're the best thing ever. But I don't necessarily know this person. I've never seen them riding, but they're out there. You know, it's a really interesting phenomenon.
And that's not science. One guy getting something to work is not science. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's true.
You know, there was this rumor going around that we were closing, I think it was closing high speed rebound, and then you tune through the low speed. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there'd always be this guy, oh man, I did it, it's amazing. And then everybody would pick that up and say that that's what we were doing and that was fact. And no matter what you said, it would always be, yeah, but my friend's doing it and he says it's great.
Yeah. Amen. Yeah.
Cool. Good luck again. Have at it.
I remember, it was actually a great story. A couple of years ago, there was a certain fork out at the time, which I personally didn't necessarily feel was all that great. And this guy came in the shop and he was telling me how amazing. And I was like, oh, no, fair enough. And I mean, he was waxing lyrical for a long time. And then he said that he needed his compression faster and his rebound firmer. And I was like, oh, right, this is what's happening, is it? Now I understand. And I, you know, and you kind of suggest, do you mean? He was like, nope, I know what I mean. I'm like, roger that, Papa Tango. Now, with this, all this exciting new things coming from the brand, which must be really exciting for you guys, I've had it both sides, because I was working for Polygon UR. I don't know if you recall, we had a kind of digital camo square one downhill bike, which Mick and Tracy were riding. And it was very frustrating because people would say, can I take a picture of it? And we'd say, sorry, you can't take a picture of it. And they'd say, but when Tracy rides out the pits 2 meters away, can I take a picture of it? It's like, well, we can't stop you taking a picture of it. And it was in videos and it was, you know, it was really ultra frustrating. One of the annoying things about that was anytime we wanted to do a pro bike or anything, you know, or just media, we'd have to build up a DH9. The previous generation for like a year. It was ridiculous. Now, what is going on with embargoes? Because I feel that it's quite hard. Now I'm on the other side of the spectrum and I was asking Greg Gallahan as nicely as I could in my sweetest voice to take some pictures of his forks and he wouldn't let me. And I was like, dude, we're going to get hours of footage of you riding the Andy Specifico. Can you just please let me just take a... And he was like, I'm really, really sorry, but... And it's right there. How do you respond to that? How do you feel about it?
I don't know. I'm kind of the same mind, whereas if that thing's in our pit and we're working on it, it's definitely disrespectful to reach your camera over the wall and take pictures. And we've had it happen a lot. And I've actually stopped people and asked them not to. And for the most part, they're like, oh, yeah, totally. I wasn't even thinking. I don't think it's going to change anything in the long run.
Yes.
Right? Those pictures are going to get out. People are going to see things. For me, it's more a matter of respect. And these guys are saying they're big fans, yet they're sneaking around trying to blow your product out and then calling you out. Like, I've made a few mistakes and posted some things with something in the background that shouldn't have been there.
Yeah.
And immediately some dick will tag Pink Bike, Vital, everything, and I'll call them out and say, hey man, I just made a mistake there, and you're calling out every social site possible.
Yeah.
Do you think this is cool? It's like, oh, I'm just a fan, man. I'm just trying to get other people to see this stuff.
But that's just like social media in a nutshell, isn't it? Because, you know, without going off on too much of a tangent, I think when social media came out, there was just this beautiful sort of outlook, like, we can make our own media now, and all that toxic tabloid stuff is going to be gone. But then we are it. We see something interesting. We pap it. We just turn into the paparazzi. Oh, get it. Get on. So tag everyone. And it's a really good, it's an interesting distillation of some of the problems of social media. Because I'm sure if they saw, you know, if they saw, like I say, I don't know, if they saw it happen, they'd probably be like, oh, that's a bit annoying. Like, come on. Like, you know, they heard both sides. They would probably judge it as be like, come on.
I think part of it too is that they see this big corporation building all these products and they see it as them versus us. But when you really narrow it down, there's like four of us working on this product that we've been working on for years, you know, like buried long hours, and it's a passion. And then some guy comes and reaches his phone through your wall and sneaks a picture between a couple people. And it hurts. Like, it's a bummer.
Do you think that the mountain biking industry has maybe kind of brought this upon itself with what I would call less sincere embargoes of products. You know, I mean, I think sometimes like it's a bit frustrating for people. I don't think people mind when they know something's a prototype and then it gets released. What they, you know, I mean, I think without trying to, I think it's all right to say, I think everyone knew it happened. There was an incident with an enduro bike at Whistler that basically got with digital camo, oh my God, prototype spotted. And the next day it was like 6 month review or whatever. Do you think that kind of the industry's kind of taken the piss a bit and started using it as a bit of a marketing ploy?
A bit, except what, so what our process is we're not really cracking down on photos. We're asking not to, but we're not releasing any technical data. We allowed people to post photos or ride, like in Portugal, there were a ton of pictures of the 40 that nobody really picked up on. They're just like, oh, white 40 again. Like, it's a whole new fork and nobody's really noticed.
Yeah, right.
But when somebody did say something, you just said, hey, there's no details right now. And that shuts everything down. Like, how many pictures are people going to look at? They can speculate.
Yeah.
But it gets boring if there's no information.
Yeah.
So
yeah, 'cause it's just conjecture.
I guess what we kind of look for is giving certain people things to ride and let them process that and form an opinion. And then when the embargo day is lifted, you don't have to wait another month or whatever it is for somebody to actually ride the product and get some information out there. You get it all instantly when things are available.
And I've got to say, in recent years, I think that generally the mountain biking industry has become a lot more transparent in technical info. But for a bike nerd, the Ride Fox technical drawings are so good. Like, it's all on there. You know what I mean? Like, dimensions of shims, everything, whatever you want to do. And as somebody that, like I said, is still a fan whittling apart his bike at home, it's just so sick to be like, you know, to be able to actually look at stuff. I think it's just fantastic.
That's awesome, because that only started when I started at Fox, and my boss and I were huge proponents of getting all of our info out there. Our website was pretty tight, and you couldn't find tech drawings, you couldn't find valve specs. And that was a huge, huge push to get, just open all that info up and let people start, like basically empowering people to start making these decisions on their own and start learning. It's only going to help us.
When talking of speculation and conjecture, when I started seeing pictures, the 38 was coming, then that new arch on the 40, I had kind of all my fingers and all my toes crossed, and this is going to be not to everyone's taste, but I thought there might be a double crown 38 coming. I thought that that new 40 might in fact be 38 mil in diameter, and then suddenly it adds a whole load of options. I imagine there are a couple of different aspects that I find this really interesting. I imagine in a fork, there is a certain amount of real estate, you know, that's limited. If the sanctions are longer, that would alleviate that problem potentially. But also, I suppose, with a single crown fork going bigger tubes to get extra stiffness, when are we going to be at the limit of the tapered head tube? When are we going to have to either start beefing up that part of the bike? I know you guys are doing really interesting things with the steerer this year, but is there going to be any time soon you think that actually we'll have to go to more clamps?
Probably not anytime soon. I think we still have quite a bit of room to make things better with a single crown. And there's definitely limitations to trail bike riding with a triple clamp fork, not to mention steering lock is a concern for a lot of people. I know certain people have ridden them for years. I guess it also is kind of terrain dependent.
Yes, true.
But yeah, whether or not we're going to see.
But I mean, cards on the table, they're absolutely hideous, which doesn't help. But that doesn't bother me. Actually, I think that we'll learn to love it. You know, it will be fine. In a couple of years, it will just be like, yeah, they're all right. And people will be putting multi-tools in the top. People are going to do loads of weird stuff. People, you know what I mean? I just think, like, for me, I guess I would like to see, with a bigger fork, I think something is going to have to change in terms of the 1 1/8, 1.5 taper. Like that seems the logical step. If not, and we want to stick with that because it's nice to have at least a couple of standards, well, we're going to have to get some, you know, some kind of
But if you do a triple clamp fork, you also have to work with manufacturers because none of those frames are approved for triple clamps for the most part.
Yes.
So either way, you'd have to start changing standards or updating things, which wouldn't really be hard if they just adapt a downhill headset, you know, 1.5 straight or however you want to do it.
It's so funny because, you know, I mean, I'm standing here talking about it, and it's more of a racing application. I'm very interested because for me, to be honest, when I've had 36s in the past, and I've always thought, bloody hell, this is plenty stiff for me, you know, as a general rider. So it's more of a kind of an interesting thing, especially with the conversation going on about negative air and the two air chambers. I just wondered whether, you know, instead of going south, we could be going north, you know.
It's possible.
Yeah. But then again, it is very ugly and people wouldn't like it.
Definitely. And you're going to see some more frame damage as, you know, as people crash and send stanchions into the side of the frame.
Yeah. I wonder if that will ever come, because I feel that eventually something's got to give, and that's how I feel anyway. But thank you very much for coming on the GMBN podcast.
Ah, you're very welcome.
Entertaining some of my more long-winded questions. Now, guys, don't forget to tune in to go over to, is it Ride Fox, your YouTube channel, or is it just Fox?
It's Ride Fox Bike.
Yeah, go over to Ride Fox Bike, check out the Dells series. It's got everything from full rebuilds, getting to know the guys. It's just fantastic. And thank you very much for coming on the GMBN podcast.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it.